So what is a game for if you don't play? What do we mean by games people don't play? So it turns out that games are a very nice way of looking at many mathematical phenomena, and even if they're not games that are actually designed for people to play. And looking at a question in terms of a game between two people or a game between one person and nature is a very useful way to look at some problems, especially in the theory of computing, which is an area of mathematics that I do a lot of my work in. So here's a little bit of what I just said, and I want to introduce you to this character. This is the enemy, the adversary, and if you do the theory of computing and you're interested in designing algorithms that work even when the input is not the kind of input you might want. That's called worst-case analysis, and that's what most computer science analysis, you hope, is based on. And for that, you imagine that you have an adversary, and we'll see him in action in some of these games. Okay. So, let me start with a very basic number game. I'm going to write down two different integers, and there's no bound on the range. It could be anywhere from minus infinity to plus infinity. I've got in my pocket here. There's one of them. Here's another one. And now I need a volunteer from the audience. Yeah? Okay, sure. Come on. I'll get you next time. Okay. I've got two different integers in my fist. Pick one of my fists, whichever one you like. I get to see the number that's there. Yeah. Hold it up. Oh, that's a good question. Very good question. I could win this game either way. It was supposed to be this way. But, I should have used a different number than 81. So here's the question. This will win you a dollar or possibly lose you a dollar. Is that the larger or the smaller of these two numbers?
Larger.
The larger. I guess it's the larger. Okay. Let's see.
It's going to be another reversal.
It's not, though. It's 65. Yes, correctly. Thank you very much. What's your name?
Teddy.
Teddy. Good job. All right. Now what I'd like to do is I'd like to tell you what to do when you have to play this game or your life instead of knowledge. So what can you do here? I mean, you don't know anything about how I choose my number. That's me. Any way you can guess that I choose my numbers might or may not be. Is there a strategy that you can have for this game that beats random guessing? I mean, you can always flip a coin to decide whether it's a bigger or a smaller number and win the game with probability 50%. Can you do better? Well, it doesn't look like that there's anything you could do if you don't understand anything about how the numbers are concocted. But in fact, it turns out there is.
Okay. So here's a quick review, right? Two different numbers are picked. You get to pick a hand and open it. Here's an example where the number turned out to be minus 617. And now you have to decide, is it the larger or the smaller of the two numbers? Okay? And here is how you can win this game with probability better than 50%. First of all, what you need to do is you need to pick a random number. Okay? And I mean a random number between minus infinity and infinity. How do you do that? Well, what you'd really like to do is choose a number uniformly at random. Now, some of you may know that that's problematical. That is problematical. But for the purposes of this puzzle, you don't need to do that. All we need is some way to pick a random number
that could end up with any number. Okay? For example, you could flip a coin to decide whether the number is non-negative or negative. And then you could keep flipping the coin until you get a head, and that would tell you how many flips would be the random number. So if you decide it's going to be negative and then you flip five tails and then a head, maybe the number turns out to be minus six. Okay, so that would be one way of doing it. All right, so what are you going to do with this number? All right. Okay, take the number, add a half to it. All right, suppose the number was 15. Okay, then it now becomes 15 and a half, and that number becomes your random threshold. And you're going to use that number to decide how to play the game.
How do you do that? Okay, very simple.
When you open first a random one of my two hands, you look at the number. If it's bigger than your threshold, you guess that it's the larger number. If it's smaller than your threshold, you guess that it's the smaller number. That's pretty simple, but why should this work?
Okay. Well, why indeed?
Okay. Well, suppose you did pick 15 as your number, and suppose my two numbers were 81 and 65, which they were. Okay? And, well, then what's going to happen? You pick a random number. But whichever one you pick, you're going to guess that it's the bigger number. And you'll be right half the time. Okay? On the other hand, suppose that the threshold happened to be 110. Right? Then, whichever number you pick, the 81 or the 65, you would be guessing that it's the smaller number. You'd be right if you got the 65, you'd be wrong if you got the 81, 50-50. So far, it's still 50-50. But it's possible that the threshold will land between two numbers.
Okay, that is the key. Okay?
If it lands between the two numbers, you'll be guessing right no matter which number you pick, and that's where you beat the 50%. Okay? You don't beat it by much, necessarily, but you do beat 50%. And so this is it's a nice example, I think, that Manuel Blum has used in teaching theoretical computer science, the power of a randomized algorithm, an algorithm that makes use of a random value.
Okay, let's make a slight variation on this game. All right. So
in this game, I don't get to pick the numbers anymore. The number will be picked by chance, by Tyche, the goddess of chance, actually. And it's going to be a random real number between 0 and 1. Right? So it could be a half, or pi over 4, or any real number between 0 and 1. Chosen uniformly at random. Okay. Now, can I borrow you now for a moment? What's your name?
Reuben.
Okay, Reuben, stand over here. So here's what's going to happen. You're again going to get to look at a number. You're going to again get to try to guess whether it's a larger number or a smaller number. Okay. Now the numbers were not chosen by me. They were chosen by the goddess of chance. Let's take my word for it. But here's the deal. You don't get to pick the number for my two fists. I get to look at these two numbers. And I get to decide which one you see. Okay, here you go, Reuben. What do you got there?
0.352.
Okay, what do you think? Is it the smaller number or the larger number?
I'm going to say smaller.
You're going to say smaller. Seems like reasonable, right? After all, there are more numbers that are bigger than 0.352 than there are smaller. And you... Very good guess. Thank you very much. Do you want to find out if you're right? He was right.
Okay. You both got to collect your dollars afterwards.
Okay. Now. So,
you can think of several algorithms for playing this game. Maybe what Ruben did was he decided that if the number was less than half, he was going to say it was smaller. And if the number was greater than half, he would say it was larger. That's a perfectly reasonable thing. Or maybe he could have used a random threshold, like he did for the previous number. And compare the number with the random threshold. Seems a lot like the previous game, doesn't it? Except that maybe this one, since I don't get to pick the number, ought to be easy. But here's the surprise.
Here's the rest of the rules. And here's the surprising conclusion that you can't get an advantage in this game. I mean, even though the numbers are picked by chance, the fact that I get to decide which number Ruben sees will force him to be able to do no better than 50%. Even if he knows my precise strategy. Okay, what do I mean by strategy? Well, the numbers were given to me by Taiki, but I get to decide which number he sees. Okay, so here's my strategy. Okay, I always show him, as I just did, the number that's closer to a half. Okay, and I claim that even if he knows I'm going to do that, he is completely stuck. He gets no clue. Why is that true? So, suppose the number was 0.38, okay? Now he even knows that that's the number that's closer to a half of the two. So what's the other number? Well, it's either lower than 0.38, right? Or it could be higher than 0.62. Either way, 0.38 would be the number that's closer to a half. But so you have a choice. The other number is either in this interval or it's in this interval. What do you think? You know, those intervals are the same size. So the probabilities are the same. 50-50. And that works for any x. And so even though you know my strategy in this game, you're hopeless. What is a typical situation? We'll see maybe a couple of others. You have a game. Change the rules a little bit, everything changes. And maybe all the answers are surprises. Now let's try something else. Okay. So the following game, some of you have heard of, I think, is a favorite of Paul Hamill's. In fact, I learned it from Paul myself. And it goes like this, okay? You and your friend, your former friend perhaps, are sharing a chocolate bar, which is in the shape of an M by N grid. Now, my artwork is not that great, but so this is your chocolate bar, like it or not. And this particular one is 6x4, but it could be anything by anything. Okay, we'll assume it's got more than one square in at least. All right. So how does the game work? Well, you take turns chopping, and here's how you chop. You pick any uneaten square that you want. And so there's a square. Okay. And when you pick a square, you chop off everything that's north and east of it. Ready? Chomp. Okay? So maybe that was your turn, and now maybe it's your opponent's turn, and maybe she picks that square, and she goes chomp, like that. So you can see how this goes. All right, so that's fine. I mean, if the object were to get a lot of chocolate, it wouldn't be a very interesting game. You take the lower left-hand corner and eat the whole bar, and that would be the end of that. However, there is a catch here. Here's the catch. The southwest corner square is poison. Okay. And if you are the one forced to eat that square, big surprise, you lose. Maybe worse than that, but let's just say you lose. Okay. So you want to be eating this chocolate bar kind of carefully. You don't want to be stuck with that square in the lower left-hand corner. All right. So now you can imagine several possibilities for how this game might go.
For example, if the chocolate bar happens to be a perfect square, so n by n, then there's a symmetry strategy that the first player can use to win the game. One possibility is to take the square here and everything with it. That leaves two equal legs. And then whenever your opponent eats something from one leg, you eat the same thing from the other leg. So there are some cases where you can see a winning strategy. And it's not hard to figure out what the winning strategy is if the game is, say, 1 by n. You guys can work that out. 2 by n has been worked out. 3 by n has been worked out. But what's the general story? Well, the general story is sort of a sad fact. You know, you guys are, in many cases, old enough to know this. But when you go to grade school, junior high school, it's easy to think that, number one, all theorems are true. And number two, mathematicians can do anything. It's just a question of your learning how. Yeah, so mathematicians are actually, you'll find out, not omnipotent by any means. And here's one of those embarrassing situations. The sad fact is, what did I do here? Maybe I just click on next, I'll get there. Here we go. Okay. It turns out that the first player always has a chocolate, no matter what M and N are, as long as there's more than one square in this chocolate bar, the first player can always win this game. What's so sad about that? Unless you're the second player. So, the sad fact is, we don't know how. The sad fact is that the first player can always win this game, and we basically have no idea how. Okay. Now, you might ask us, how do we arrive at a situation where we know who wins the game and we don't know how? Right? I mean, if someone told you that their computer has just finished churning and the white player can force a win at chess, you wouldn't believe him. You would say, okay, how? Okay, now, of course, if the same guy told you that his computer just proved the four-color theorem, you might just believe him. I wouldn't. Okay. But here, I can actually show you how we know that the first player wins without showing you how the first player wins. Okay? And here it is. So pay careful attention to this. Okay. All right. The point is this. Somebody has a win. For any given M&M, any given chocolate bar size, somebody has a winning strategy. This is a finite game. It ends in a finite number of moves. Somebody must have a winning strategy, and if it isn't Alice, the first player, it must be Bob, the second player. Okay? So far, so good? You guys know Alice and Bob? You familiar with Alice and Bob? Right. Alice always goes first, Bob goes second. They're familiar characters in computer science, game theory, and increasingly, I think, in a lot of mathematics. Okay, so suppose, what's wrong with that? Suppose that player two has a winning strategy. Okay, then we ask the following clever question. What is Bob's winning response to Alice starting with just eating the northeast corner? Okay, so here's Bob, we imagine that Alice, the first player, eats that square, and we ask, okay, if Bob has a winning strategy, he must have some move now which ultimately gives him a winning position from which he can win the game. Sure, what's wrong with that? Maybe it's... Okay. Okay. Suppose his response is to take, for example, this square. What's wrong with that? Okay. That will result in, boom, chop. Okay, no problem. And supposedly, this is a position which is a winning position for Bob when he gets to hand the bar to Alice. However, Alice could have made that move. If this is a winning position, Alice didn't have to take the upper right-hand corner. She could have just bitten that guy right off. Now it's Bob's turn to play. Okay. So what have we got here? We have a contradiction. It's impossible that Bob has a winning strategy. If he did, Alice could steal it and beat him with it. So it must be Alice that has a winning strategy. It's a great argument. It just doesn't tell you Alice actually wins the game. It turns out there's a few games with this property. You guys ever hear of the game of Hex? So where you try to build a path across hexagonal diamond while your opponent's trying to build a path in the other direction. There's also a proof that the first player has a winning strategy in Hex. If you play it in a proper diamond. And but again, in general, nobody knows how it's done. And it's not even known that if you play Hex on, say, an 11 by 11 board, that playing the middle square, the middle hexagon, is a win for the first player. Well, it's a very embarrassing state of affairs. Some losing moves are known for the first player. But no winning move is known for the first player, even though we know the first player has a winning move. Okay, it's embarrassing truth here. Okay, here's a game I ran in. I devised myself as a result of some stuff I did in class back in Emory days. Okay, you're offered the following game. Right. Now this is a pretty silly game. If you want a random number between 1 and 6 and you have a die, you can roll it. Okay. But here's another crazy number, way to get a number between 1 and 6. A non-uniformly random number between 1 and 6. Roll 6 dice and count the number of different numbers that appear. Okay, so who's fast here? If I roll this, what number have I got? 4. Oh, everybody's fast. Okay. All right, so that's a 4. If all these were 5s, what number would I have?
1.
Good. Okay. Quick studies in this room. Okay. And here's the deal. If you get 4, you win a buck. Not bad, but we just got a 4. Otherwise, you lose a buck. Now, this is a test for your intuition here. If you play this game, say you play this game once a minute, and you start with $100, on average, how long would it take before you lost your $100? Okay. So, that's got to take at least 100 minutes. But you certainly won't be that unlucky. You're going to be rolling some 4s. So, do you think like 300 minutes would be enough?
Nah.
What do you think? 1,000 minutes? Maybe it would take all day. Yeah, it turns out infinitely long. Infinitely long, okay. So what does that mean? That means that with positive probability, you will never run out of money playing this game. And that can only be the case if this game is actually favorable to you. It must be the case that even though there are 6 different numbers that you can roll, you actually roll a 4 by itself more than half the time. I thought that was a remarkable discovery. If you like to do combinatorics, you know, combinations and permutations, it's a good calculation, or you can do it with your class. Bring it to your teacher, Reuben. He or she will love that. And, of course, the fact, since this is a favorable game, that means that you'll never actually be offered it. That's the bad luck. But maybe you can, you know, offer it to somebody else. Okay. So, here's a game that I think is kind of a lot of fun. So I like to play cards. I've also written a book on bridge, and I like to play poker, and maybe some of you also like to play cards. And here's a game you've never played and probably never will, but let's imagine it. Okay? I have a deck of cards that's well shuffled. Does anybody know how many times you're supposed to shuffle a deck of cards? Yeah, there's... It's an interesting story about shuffling. Shuffling cards is very closely related to some work that I do in statistical physics. And there's a famous result that you should do riffle shuffles 7 times, and which was promulgated by Dave Beyer and Percy Diaconis. And they wrote a very beautiful paper about that. But the paper says nothing about 7 inside. So every time you read about this 7, you get the paper as a reference. And then you read this paper, and there's no 7 in this paper. Well, later on, after getting, well, it sort of starts to level out at 7, so 7 is a good number of shuffles. It turns out that if you want to know how many times you have to shuffle so that you have, on average, a perfectly shuffled deck. In other words, how long does it take to shuffle a deck on average if you manage to stop it just when it's perfectly shuffled? That turns out to be 11 3/4. That's an interesting fact here. 3/4 of a shuffle is something we'll talk about later. Okay. But in this game, we imagine that every one of the 52 factorial ways, and that's a lot of ways of ordering a deck of cards, is equally likely, perfectly shuffled. And now we start turning over cards one at a time. Okay. So, and the way you play the game is anytime you want, imagine I'm turning over the cards, anytime you want, you can stop me and bet that the next card is going to be red. Okay? And as usual, $1 is at stake here. Okay, if you get it, if it is red, you win your dollar. If it's not, you lose. And you do have to stop me. So this might be the situation you're in right now. We've dealt these cards, and you're going to bet that the next card is going to be red. I'll flip it over. And you must bet on some card, right? So if you want, you can wait for the last card. And since there are 26 black cards in a deck and 26 red cards in a deck, if you do that, you'll know in advance whether you're actually going to win this or lose this. But so the question here is, what's the right strategy? So you could, if you keep flipping cards, you could get to a point when all the rest of the cards in the deck are red, and then take a sure bet. Okay. Or you could just wait. I mean, likely there'll be times when the reds are ahead and times when the blacks are ahead. You could wait for a time when you get good odds in your favor for the next. So maybe there'll be a time when there's 15 red cards left and only 12 black cards left. And you'll take your 5. You're a useful guy, you know that? You'll take your 5/9 probability of winning the game. 15 over 15 plus 12. Right? Yeah. Okay. So, but maybe having seen that you couldn't win that game where Tyke picked a random number, I'm just going to play this conservatively. I'll just play until I get even one more red card left in the remainder of the deck than black, and then I'll bet. Okay. So the question is, how much of an advantage can you get in this game? Okay. Now, my intuition was that you could get, by playing conservatively, you could get a small advantage, maybe 5% or something like that. And because, you know, most of the time there'll be some point when reds are one ahead, and most likely it'll end up being like 21 reds to 20 blacks or something like that. It won't be much of an advantage, but it'll be something. But maybe some of you have guessed the truth. What's the truth? Yeah, the truth is, all strategies are equally good, and that's the bad news. The good news is, all strategies are also equally bad. Okay? No matter how you play this game, no matter what you do, it's a fair game for your $1. Okay? Now, what I like about this is, partly the conclusion is a little bit surprising, maybe, but also, I like the proof. I'm going to show you the proof of this one. Okay? Again, watch carefully. Here's the reasoning. Okay. So what I'm going to do is, I'm going to consider a slight variation of this game. Okay? The way this variation works is that cards are turned over. Okay. And you stop me whenever you like. And now you bet that the last card, the bottom card of the deck, is red. Not the next card, but the bottom card. Okay? Now, so how does this game compare with the other one? So there's a bottom card peeking out. You're going to win this one. Okay? All right. So the point is, at any point in this game, the probability that the bottom card is red is exactly the same as the probability that the top card is red. It's the number of red cards divided by the total number of cards left in the deck. Okay. So whatever strategy you use in the original game will have exactly the same effect in this game. Right? You wait for more red cards than black, and then you bet red, fine, okay? And we pull out the last card instead of the top card. But there's something fishy about this variation of the game. Right? When do you win this variation of the game? When the bottom card is red. It doesn't matter what you do. Either the bottom card was red when we started this game, or it was black when we started this game. When we decide to stop the cards and bet on it, it's not going to affect it. It's 50-50. So that must be true for the original game as well. This variation is trivial. It's the same game as the previous game. But in this game, you can see that no strategy is going to make any difference. The card's either red or it's not. Everybody's in silence now. Okay, let's see what happens. What have I got next, anyway? Oh, yeah. So I wanted to give you guys a homework problem to work on. This problem is trickier. So if you're having trouble with it, go look for me later on or ask Ruben. Okay. Here it is. Okay. This time, I'm going to give you a game which really is a favorable game to play. Okay. This time, the deck is shuffled, cards are turned over one at a time. You begin the game with a dollar, but at any time you may bet any portion of whatever amount of money you have left on either color for the next card. So I could start by betting a nickel that the first card is black if I want to. Or I could pass on the first card, and if it's black, I could bet a nickel the next card is red. What else could I do? Well, one sure way of coming home with some money is let this sit there and wait for the whole deck to go by. And then I'll know what the color of the last card is. I'll bet my dollar on that. I get $2. That's pretty good. And maybe I can even do a little better, because it might be that I'll get to a point when the last three cards are all black, or the last three cards are all red, or something like that. And then I can, I can make more money. I can double my money three times if I get that money. Okay. So the game's definitely in my favor now. And the question is, I can use any strategy I want to play. How much money can I guarantee to take home? For example, can I guarantee to win, to take home $3, $5, $10? Okay. The strategy will guarantee two. Is there any way to guarantee more? Clear? Okay. Now, so I've given myself an out here, right? If I finish early, I can go back to this thing and show you the analysis. But now I'm going to raise the stakes. There's no more dollar. Okay. Here's the deal. Time for a little geometry. And you are now in a large rectangular room. That's easy to imagine, right? Here we are in a large rectangular room. But the room in our imagination has mirrored walls, perfect mirrors all around. Okay. That's very good if we're prepping for a fancy dress ball. but it's not good in the current situation, and the reason is
that elsewhere in the room is your enemy with a laser gun. Okay? So you are in big trouble. Okay? Now there's some good news and some bad news here. Okay? The bad news, of course, is that he has a lot of ways to kill you. He could just aim the gun directly at you, or he can aim in a zillion different directions and have it bounce off the walls and still kill you. Okay? Good news is that you've actually lost a lot of weight recently, and viewed from above, you are a point. So is he. Okay? That's good news. Bad news again, he has good aim. He has really good aim. He knows exactly how to aim the gun directly at you, either on a direct shot or any kind of a carom. Okay? So, we need some more good news here. So far, this is not going well. Okay, the good news is that you have bodyguards that you can summon to try to protect you from this shot. Okay? Graduate students are good for this. The bodyguards are also points. The bodyguards are also points. And you can place these points anywhere you want. And you, what you want to do is you want to place them so that you are safe. You can't move. The enemy can't move. But if you block these, put these bodyguards down in the right place, what you're hoping is you can block all the shots. So the question, of course, is how many bodyguards do you need? Okay. So let's think about this just a little bit. So do you guys know that there's more than one kind of infinity? A lot of you do. Because I know a lot of people in this room know it very well. Okay. And first of all, I want you to notice that if we have continuum many bodyguards, that we're going to be okay. We have continuum many bodyguards. We can arrange them in a circle around ourselves, right? And if we're smart, the enemy will be outside the circle. Okay? And now you're okay. So the answer is, you can do it with continuum many. Can you do any better? Okay. Well, let me show you a trick that you can use that really helps with many problems involving billiards. Okay? Here's the idea. What you can do is, you draw this, think of this as a billiards table on a plane, and what you can do is, you can make a reflected copy. What I've done is I've flipped this copy over, and you see there's a reflected copy of your enemy in this reflected room. And then I could do another one here and here and here, and then I could do more here and here and here and all around. And what I can do is I can cover the entire plane with these reflected copies of the room with reflected copies of our enemy on it. Okay? So what's the point of that? The point of that is this. If we look at any shot made by one of our virtual enemies here in some other reflected room, okay, that translates to a real carom shot by the real enemy in the real room. Okay, and conversely, every way that the enemy has of shooting you with his laser gun bouncing off the walls can be viewed as a straight line shot by one of the virtual enemies out there on the plane. Okay? Now, how many of those virtual enemies are there? Infinitely many, but only countably infinitely many. Right? Like one for each number. Okay, so it's not so bad. It's not so bad. Only, that's still a lot of bodyguards, but this is countably many bodyguards. And what you can do is you could simply take every one of these countable things and put a bodyguard in that path somewhere and block all the shots. Okay? So,
So far, so good. But this argument does not show yet that you actually need infinitely many bodyguards, because it's possible that you can a well-placed bodyguard can block more than one of these shots, right? Maybe even infinitely many of these shots, if you're really lucky. So the real number of bodyguards that you need is, by the way, here's all the shots, 16 bodyguards. Okay. Now, 16? Where do you get 16? Well, 16 is 4 squared. It's also 2 to the 4th. It's got some nice properties. Where does it come from? So let me just give you an idea of where this comes from. So if you go back to the original, let's go back to the previous slide for a moment. So, even here, right? So the idea is that what we're going to do is we're going to try to block every possible shot in the middle of that shot. Actually, halfway, if you follow the photons, between your enemy and you. Okay? And in order to do that, in order to find out where those points are, what we can do is we can take a picture of this thing or make a tracing on tracing paper, and then we could shrink the whole picture by a factor of 2 in both directions. Okay? And then all these pink virtual bodyguards will be halfway toward you from where they were before. So we can put bodyguards in all of those pink places. Okay, well, there's still infinitely many of them. But we now have a pattern. And we discover that if we look at that pattern, that they only make 16 points in each one of these squares. They look something like this. So, interesting. So a little bit of the history of this problem. It appeared first on an Olympiad. So you guys have heard of the math Olympiads. You know, they have these international things. They start in villages, and then they move to towns, and they move to cities, and they move to states, and then countries, and finally the winners of all these contests meet somewhere and with their corresponding internationals from all over the globe. It's a great system, and it's a lot of fun. And supposedly the problems get harder as you go from village to town to city to state, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that was not always the case. And in fact, the problems that you hit in the cities of Moscow or Leningrad, before it became St. Petersburg, were very tough, likely to be tougher than problems that other kids are getting in their country. And this problem was one of the ones that appeared on the Leningrad exam. It's a pretty tough problem. But it got a lot of interest, and it turned out that it started a whole little mini branch of geometry. People were writing articles on what other polygons have the property that you can block all the shots with a finite number of bodyguards. So it started a little branch of mathematics all by itself. Okay. How are we doing? Oh, pretty good. You guys want to see one more game?
Yeah.
All right. Since it looks apparently you guys can handle the infinite. Okay. So let's really face the infinite now. I want to play a two-move. So what is ZFC? Anybody know what ZFC is? Paul, what is it? Something, right? Right. Very good. Yeah. A little bit of cooperation here. This is something pretty abstruse here. It stands for Zermelo-Frankel with the axiom of choice. What it is, it's the basic axioms of set theory that we use to do mathematics. 99% of mathematics. Virtually all of analysis, topology, algebra, and not to mention applied mathematics, engineering, is done with this theory as the background, Zermelo-Frankel set theory with the axiom of choice. And so what I'd like to do is I'd like to propose that the two players who are playing this game are mathematicians. They live in this world. Okay? They're Alice and Bob, and they're not afraid to play infinite games. Okay? Okay? They can deal with infinity. And they're going to play the following pretty simple two-move game. Right? Just two moves. One move by Alice, one move by Bob. That's it. I'm not counting moves the chess way. This is just two moves, one by each player. Okay? In Alice's turn, she picks a sequence of real numbers. Okay? And she can pick them any way she wants, randomly or deterministically. She just picks a sequence of real numbers, x1, x sub 2, x sub 3, etc., etc. And she puts each one in a box. Okay? So far, no problems you can deal with the infinite. That's it for Alice. Our numbers are in these boxes. Now it's Bob's turn. Bob gets to open as many boxes as he wants. He can even open infinitely many boxes and look at the real numbers inside. Okay? But he must leave one box unopened, and then he must guess the number in that box. Okay? If that number is pi over 4, he has to guess pi over 4. Okay? Something a little more or less than pi over 4 will not work. Okay. That's how he wins the game. If he misses the real number, no matter how close he is, if he misses as good as a mile, he loses the game. Okay. So who do you want to be in this game? Alice or Bob?
Alice.
Of course you want to be Alice! Thank you. The horrifying fact is that Bob can win this game with probability 99%. Okay. Now that's ridiculous, right? I mean, that's clearly ridiculous. But this is not a trick. Well, it is a trick and it's not a trick. It's not a trick in the sense that it's a theorem. In ZFC, Bob can win this game with probability 99%. Or actually, 1 minus epsilon for any epsilon that he wants. 99.99% if he prefers. Okay? This is a consequence of the ridiculous axiom that we use to do almost all of mathematics. Okay? All right. Now, do I get to till 7:30? Okay. So I can do... In 5 minutes, I can either tell you how Bob wins this game, or I can tell you how to play the game where we bet on the cards. Okay? You want to see this game? Okay, you want to see it? All right, so this is... All right, now this is a little bit of a sophisticated proof, but it's not... But it's explicable. It's the kind of thing where you listen to this proof, and maybe you'll go home and say, I want to check this out because this is, the conclusion doesn't make any sense. Okay, but this is how it's done. All right, so I don't have this on a slide, so I'll explain it to you. All right, so here's the deal. Bob is first going to think about a notion of similarity between sequences and real numbers. Got some sequence of real numbers, say y1, y2, y3, and another one, z1, z2, or z3 for the Canadians, etc. Okay, and he's going to say that these two are similar if they agree, except for maybe finitely many discrepancies. So maybe Y3 is not equal to Z3. And maybe Y41 is not equal to Z41, but the rest of the numbers are only all other indices YI equals 0. Okay. And then these are called similar. Okay? Now this notion is what we call in mathematics an equivalence relation. Some of you may know, an equivalence relation is a relation which is symmetrical, which this is,
which is reflexive. In other words, any two things are equivalent, anything that's equivalent to itself. And it also has to be transitive, which means that if this sequence is similar to that one, and this sequence is similar to another one, or if I don't play the alphabet, then this sequence is similar to that one. That's also true. Okay? And that means that all the sequences of real numbers, and there are a lot of them, in the world, break up into equivalence classes, classes of similar sequences. Okay? What Bob is going to do is he's going to pick a representative from each equivalence class. Every set of equivalence classes, he's going to pick one sequence. For example, one of the equivalence classes consists of all real sequences that are zero except in finitely many places. Okay? So maybe Bob picks from that class the sequence of all zeros. Or maybe a one followed by all zeros. Okay. He does that for every one of these equivalent classes. A lot of work. And he needs a big computer to store all these representatives. But he does that, and he can do it before the game is played, and he can even do it without the game of balance. Okay? So far, so good? Now we have. So now the game starts. Alice puts out her boxes, and Bob arranges the boxes in 100 rows. Right? So here's box number 1, box number 101, box number 201, etc. And here's box 2, 202, etc. 102. 202. No, yes.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And then the last one, box 100, 200, I've got this right now, right? 200, 300, etc. Okay. So he's arranged in this big rectangle. Okay. And now he picks a uniformly random number between 1 and 100. So I need a number here. So 72. Good one. Okay. That's going to work. All right. So he picks this random number, 72. Remember this number. Oops, I can write it literally. I can't. There we go. Okay. And now what he does is, he opens all the boxes in the first row. All. Okay. Now, and he said that, and he looks at what equivalence class that sequence of real numbers is in, and he compares it with his representative from that class. So this row and this row's representative from the same class are going to differ in only finitely many places. And Bob is going to write down the number in sequence of the last box where they disagree. Right? So maybe they disagree in the first three and they're the same after that. So he writes down n sub 1 equals 3. That means after the third box they agree. Okay. And he does the same thing with row number 2. And so 2, that might be 4,651. It's a pretty big number, right? Last place where they disagree, but they have to disagree. There have to be some last place where they disagree, because they only disagree on the final many places. And he does that for all these things, except the 72nd row. And 100 equals 85. So he's got 99 numbers here, N1 up to N71, and N73 up to N100, just missing N70. So he takes these numbers, and he takes the max. And then he adds one.
So maybe this one was the biggest number, 4,651.
So then he lets n be 4,652. And now he finally turns his attention to the 72nd row, and he opens all the boxes past the nth box. Alright, so it opens box number 4,653, 4, 5, etc., all the way up to infinity. And that puts him in one of these equivalence classes, because he doesn't need to know any finite number. But it puts him in some equivalence class, he finds the representative from that equivalence class, and he guesses that the representative and the 72nd sequence agree in the nth box. Here's the deal. I claim, so what's the missing number here was N72. If N72 is less than M, that means Bob wins. What does it mean that N72 is less than M? It means that the last place where the 72nd row differed from its representative came before the nth box. So when Bob guessed that the nth box agreed with the representative, he was right. Okay. So Bob wins if n sub 72 is less than m. Well, why should n sub 72 be less than m? Well, the only way it could be more than m is if n 72 is the biggest of all the n's. Because m was bigger than the maximum of all the n's. So Bob loses only if 72 happens to be the biggest number, happened to have the biggest n sub I. Well, Bob got to pick this number from 1 to 100 by himself. So he's got a 99% chance to win this game. He wins unless n sub 72 happens to be the biggest n sub I. Okay? It's ridiculous, right? But it's actually a legitimate proof. Right? I think my theory is here that this isn't really any more surprising than the Banach-Tarski paradox, which is also a consequence of ZFC, which says that you can take a solid ball and cut it into five pieces and make two solid balls each the same size as the original one. But people are familiar with that when they know how to get around it. This one is something we're not familiar with. It's equally ridiculous, but it's a genuine consequence of the axiom choice. It's curious that I think that the axiom choice favors Bob in this game. You would think that Alice is the one who gets to pick this real sequence. That might favor her, but it's the other way around. Okay, this is it. My point is, conceptual games can help us understand mathematics and help us do mathematics. And I thank you very much for listening. 'll be happy to take questions. Yes.
In the game where you are betting on the bigger or smaller number,
yes,
do they know what's the most advantageous? The best strategy, what probability it wins with?
Okay, so here's the deal. To get for you, the guesser,
yeah, sure,
to get an advantage, you have to manage to get your random threshold between my two numbers.
Right.
Okay. So if I pick my two numbers so that they're really big positive numbers or really big negative numbers that are only one apart,
right,
then the probability that you're going to be able to slide your random threshold in between them is going to be really teeny.
Sure.
Okay. So this is my best strategy.
Sure.
Okay. And
there's not much you can do about it, because you can't put very high probabilities on a lot of numbers. They have to add up to one. So the answer is that although you can beat 50%, you can't get 50.001%. If I use this strategy of picking two numbers that are way out there and that are only one apart, you're going to get an imperceptible advantage only. Other questions? Yes. Oh, so I heard it from a Romanian Israeli mathematician named Sergiu Hart only a short time ago, but it is, I think, discussed on Math Overflow somewhere. I'm not sure how you can look it up. But Sergiu didn't come up with it himself either, so someone did, and I don't actually know who. And sometimes it's difficult to trace the origin of a puzzle like that. It's like finding the origin of a joke, which maybe this is a lot like.
Okay, well, let's thank our students.